Hi, my name's Eric. I'll be reading you selections from the e-edition of today's Cape Cod Times. Today's date's Wednesday, April 24th of 2024. We'll start with the weather, as we always do. Across the Cape and Islands today, cloudy and breezy. Look for a few afternoon showers coming in later this afternoon. A high of 58 expected today. Tonight and the overnight, it'll be breezy in the evening, otherwise clearing. A low of 34 expected, a little chillier than usual. Tomorrow, Thursday, plenty of sunshine, beautiful 3 days ahead of us. Thursday, Friday, Saturday will all be sunny and in the 50s. So very nice weekend lining up for us. Plenty of sunshine. Lows will be in the high 30s, low 40s in the overnight, a little chillier than usual, but the days will warm it up, so you shouldn't have too much problem with frost or anything else on the ground. Sunday looks to be cloudy. But you're, again, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday forecasts all look wonderful. So if you can get outside, feel the sun on your face, by all means, do so. Speaking of the sun, it will rise at 5:47 a.m. today. It will set at 7:32 p.m. We'll have 13 hours, 45 minutes of daylight. The moon will rise at 8:37 p.m. and set at 5:53 a.m. Now we'll head to the front of the paper where the news and, of course, the lottery results are kept. And we read these lottery results because somebody asked for them. Actually, a few people asked for them, and we're happy to give them. If you want something, we can absolutely provide it. If there's something you want to hear that we're not reading, you can email us at info@audiblelocalledger.org or call us at 508-539-2030. That's 508-539-2030, and we'll consider reading it. And if you miss any of the information that we share in our readings, and there's a lot of details like emails and phone numbers, you can always go to audiblelocalledger.org, and in the upper right corner is the Archived Readings tab. If you click on that, you'll find a week's worth of our newspaper readings, and you can catch up on anything that you might have missed. You'll also find our shopping guides up there, so you can see what's on sale at the grocery store and be able to go and make some savings. All of that is free for people who are blind or print disabled at audiblelocalledger.org. Now, for the latest results of the lottery, we go to masslottery.com because the Cape Cod Times goes to press too early to give you the latest results, and if you ask for them, you deserve them. The numbers game for Tuesday, April 23rd, in the midday drawing yesterday, the numbers were 6, 4, 2, 4. Again, yesterday's midday drawing, 6, 4, 2, 4. In the evening drawing last night for the numbers game of Tuesday, April 23rd, the results were 4, 6, 9, 3. Last night's evening drawing, 4, 6, 9, 3. Last night's mass cash drawing for Tuesday, April 23rd, 4, 15, 29, 30, and 34. Mega Millions for Tuesday, April 23rd, 11, 17, 33, 39, and 43, with 14, the bonus number. And Lucky for Life rounds out our lottery results for Tuesday, April 23rd of 2024 with 11, 31, 32, 36, and 44, with 8, the bonus number. Good luck to all who play. Remember us if you win. Now on the cover of the Cape Cod Times, the headline reads, Basketball and Life Lessons. Wampanoag Tribe and Glam Girls Bring WNBA Star to Mashpee by Rachel Devaney in Mashpee. It was a very dark time for me, former WNBA star Rinaldi Vicente told about 22 tween and teen girls at the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribal Government Center on Friday. Vicente, who played for the Phoenix Mercury in the Women's National Basketball Association, was talking about the death of mother Eleanor Vicente when Vicente was about 12 years old. At the time, Vicente's father, Raymond Vicente Sr., told her to run to her mother's grave and cry her heart out. He said, "You go talk to your mom. You tell her everything," Vicente said. "I did that, and I came back. Out of nowhere, a whirl of wind came across, and that's when I was rejuvenated," said Vicente, who is a member of the Navajo Nation, or Diné, which means the people. "I felt like that was my mom. I jumped up, I ran, grabbed a basketball, and that's when I just took off. Basketball just burst out of me. Basenti spoke during a series of basketball clinics for tribal girls as part of GLAM Camp, and that's G-L-A-M in capital letters, which was conducted by Global Local Athletic Movement, or GLAM Girl. That's an organization that helps connect young girls to sports. The week-long GLAM Camp was planned a partnership with the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe, said Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe Education Communications Coordinator Talia Landry. Girls from the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe, Wampanoag Tribe of Gayhead, and the Herring Pond Wampanoag Tribe attended, she said. I'm proud of the girls. They came together and learned lessons about how to be the strong Wampanoag women we expect them to be, said Landry. The week-long camp featured Basenti, but also world champion hammer thrower Janae Casanovoid, who appeared during a virtual workshop, martial artist Maureen Burke, women's college basketball player and Herring Pond Wampanoag tribal member Kendall Currents, and state champion basketball players Jislyn Nosey and Cameron Nashu. Basketball's always been my ticket to take me places, said Basenti, who was the first Native American woman to play in the WNBA. I'm here to teach basketball, but also life lessons. What is GLAM Girl? Throughout the week, GLAM camp attendees participated in group discussions, youth leader poetry sessions, healthy eating clinics with James Beard Award winner Sherry Pocknett, talking circles, health classes, Herring Day at the Mashpee Wampanoag Museum, nature walks, and self-defense classes. According to the GLAM Girl website, the group is a youth-founded, youth-led, club model organization that started with a vision of creating equity in sports. According to GLAM Girl co-founder Taryn Madsen, GLAM Camp is just one of many activities that GLAM Girl branches conduct across the country. Throughout everything we do, our connection is the love of the game and being athletic, said Madsen, who's a sophomore at Tabor Academy. The idea for GLAM Girl locations on Cape Cod, said GLAM Girl co-founder Tegan Lind, came after the Falmouth High School senior met deceased Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The meeting, said Lind, was organized through a family friend. She encouraged us to look at sports as one of our strengths and to make a difference through sports, said Lind. Between 2021 and 2022, Lind said she and her sister, along with co-founders Madsen and Tabor Academy sophomore Izzy Murphy, created a nonprofit and began to hold activities they felt could impact girls across the state. We wanted to make sure that all girls get the opportunity to play the sports they love, said Lind. Funding for GLAM camps and other events came from organizations like the Women and Girls Fund of Cape Cod, said GLAM Camp parent and volunteer Beth Murphy, and individual fundraisers like bake sales conducted by the co-founders. Beth Murphy said her daughter Izzy Murphy made 500 chocolate-covered strawberries at one point and sold them in a bake sale, raising $600. Those funds were used to help bring Nosey and Nashu to GLAM Camp. Amaya Frazier, who's 18, started a GLAM Girl group at Mashpee Middle High School in 2021 and said the group has inspired members to be positive and confident. This group helps girls gain a voice, said Frazier, who identifies as African American. It's been so powerful immersing myself at this camp. It's given me new perspectives and helps me have a greater appreciation of life. For Currents, who will head overseas to play professional basketball in May, GLAM programming taught tribal girls respect and how to be brave as Indigenous women. Sometimes as Indigenous people, it feels like you can't show emotion and you have to be tough all the time, said Currents. We talked about speaking up and sharing feelings. We've been silenced for too long. After retiring from basketball, Basenti said it's become her mission to influence tribal girls across the country. Basenti, who appeared with Elmo on Sesame Street and went viral in a 2022 TikTok video, said when she received a phone call to come out to attend Mashpee's GLAM camp, she didn't hesitate. Sometimes kids don't have the finances or the resources for something like this, and this kind of learning experience is important, said Basenti. Yes, we teach them ball handling and shooting drills, but we also teach women power. Basenti went through challenges as a child living in Fort Defiance, Arizona, she said, which is located on the Navajo reservation. But when she saw former WNBA player Cheryl Miller opening doors for African American women, she said she wanted to do the same. She motivated me and pushed me to excel, said Basenti. I knew it would be a tough journey, I knew it would be a battle. When Bassenti joined the Phoenix Mercury in 1997, Miller became her basketball coach. Miller's now the head women's basketball coach at California State University, Los Angeles campus. Currents said Bassenti shared stories of her struggles with glam girl campers. Bassenti's experiences showed the girls that anything is possible, Currents said. Bassenti said Currents is one of her heroes. Her parents died when she was a young age, and she grew up on a reservation where there was sometimes no running water, and sometimes she didn't know where her next meal was coming from, said Currents. But she pushed through and persevered. She became a big star. She's so inspiring. If I can inspire one child or 30 kids, it all means the world to me, said Bassenti. As Bassenti spoke to the Times, she pointed to Mashpee Wampanoag tribal member Jersey Alves, who's also a Mashpee Wampanoag Native Environmental Ambassador. During one of the basketball clinics, Bassenti said she showed Alves how to dribble 3 basketballs at one time. I told her that basketball is about rhythm. It's about energy. And she started doing it, and she got it, said Bassenti. She'll now teach other kids. It's all about transferring rhythm into love. For Beth Murphy, the week has been special for tribal and non-tribal girls involved in the camp. Instructors like Benenti and Currents, she said, had the patience and the power to bring the girls together in a very positive way. Part of why this has worked so well has been the support that Kendall and others have provided to these girls, said Murphy. Seeing the joy in their faces, well, it's incredible. For Madsen, presence is power. Throughout glam camp, the girls learned a lot about teamwork and community. But Madsen said instructors and glam girl co-founders connected with the girls and gained perspectives on the discriminations and struggles they face as indigenous women. Showing up for the girls? That's what we do. Equity is what we're all about, she said. But they also showed up for me, and I'll never forget that. We'll move to the Cape and Islands to keep it local. Guthrie retires from Falmouth Police after an investigation, by Walker Armstrong of the Cape Cod Times. An internal investigation conducted by the Falmouth Police Department found a former sergeant violated departmental policy by using marijuana, intimidating a witness, and interfering with proceedings, according to a report of the probe that was obtained by the Times. Benjamin Guthrie, 50 years old, was placed on administrative leave in February pending the results of the investigation, which was then being headed by the Massachusetts State Police as a criminal investigation. In a statement to the Times, Guthrie said the state police investigation was initiated by an erroneous allegation of domestic violence. There was a very in-depth and thorough investigation which included interviewing 4 adults that have lived and were currently residing in our home, Guthrie said. The investigation concluded there was no credibility to the allegation and no criminal charges were sought. According to the report, the internal Falmouth police probe was triggered by an allegation Guthrie used marijuana and other substances countless times in the last year, which he denied on several occasions. Despite submitting to a drug screening and testing negative for recent use, the report found evidence that overwhelmingly supports a finding that Guthrie used marijuana and other prohibited items on multiple occasions in violation of department policy. Guthrie said in his statement that he fully cooperated with the investigation, and he attributed the report's findings to witnesses whom he described as not being credible. Quote, they failed to interview the other adults that lived in the home regarding any alleged drug use, and they only questioned them regarding the erroneous domestic violence allegations, he said. I also offered to answer any additional questions they had, expressing that I didn't feel I was able to explain myself well enough because of heightened emotions. The opportunity for clarification was denied. Investigators also said Guthrie made several attempts to undermine the credibility of the investigating Falmouth police captain, Brian Reed, by texting police chief, Jeffrey Lurie, that he didn't trust Captain Reed. On a separate occasion, the report found Guthrie sent texts to an individual whose name was redacted, saying, "You might want to think further before you call the state police again." Investigators said Guthrie's actions are deemed witness intimidation. The Falmouth and State Police did not find probable cause to seek criminal charges against Guthrie. Falmouth Town Council Maura O'Keefe said Guthrie retired from the Falmouth Police Department on March 23rd. Guthrie said the investigation had torn a family apart and caused irreparable damage to him and his family. I no longer wanted to work for an agency that didn't support its officers against unsubstantiated allegations, Guthrie said in his statement. I've been labeled as an untruthful, insubordinate officer by a department that had entrusted me to be a supervisor, a leader, as well as a trainer of new and veteran officers for over 20 years. There's a photo taken by a drone, I assume, because it's an air photo looking down. Another sign of spring on a chilly April morning. Town of Yarmouth crews on Tuesday install the dock and boat slips at Gray's Beach in Yarmouthport against a backdrop of the boardwalk. I'm glad they explained that. I never would have known what was going on in that picture. I do see the boardwalk, and I do see a bunch of platforms. But it's an aerial view, which is always kind of cool. Town seal and budget items are on the agenda at Yarmouth meeting by Susan Vaughn as a special to the Cape Cod Times. The Yarmouth Town Meeting warrant on April 30th has 33 articles seeking approval of minimal budget increases, a new sewer bylaw, an updated wetlands bylaw, more firefighters, and new police cruisers. Voters will also be asked to approve a new town seal and apply for a planning and design grant for expansion of library services. The town meeting has no big bond issues this year, but it's all very important stuff to keep the town rolling, Town Administrator Robert Rittenauer said. The general budget increase is around 2.5%, he said, and the total increase, including enterprise funds, is 5.3%. The meeting starts at 6 p.m. at the Dennis Yarmouth Intermediate School at 286 Station Ave in South Yarmouth. The town meeting warrant is posted on the Yarmouth Town website for review. A Proposition 2.5 override of $880,000 is proposed. It's needed to cover Dennis Yarmouth Regional School District's assessment of $47.66 million sought in Article 8. Leaders from Dennis, Yarmouth, and the school district have collectively endorsed a 3-year step-down plan that includes the fiscal 2025 override. For a property assessed at $600,000, the override would present a $64 annual tax increase, according to a chart provided in the Finance Committee's town meeting report. For this override to pass, it also has to be approved by town meeting voters and at the May 21st town election. Another ongoing school expense of $200,000 annually is being requested for maintenance of the former Mattachese Elementary School that was turned over to the town after the new intermediate school was built. Yarmouth residents are being asked to join a utilization committee to make decisions about the future of the building. Further sewer treatment requests will be there. Several articles relate to the planned construction of a sewer treatment plant and collection system that was approved for $207 million at last year's town meeting. One article asks for adoption of Massachusetts General Law Chapters 80 and 83. For the purpose of establishing a municipal sewer system. A second article establishes a Yarmouth sewerage bylaw to implement the system, outlining the district boundaries, management, and budget, and adding a board of commissioners. Another article asks for approval for wastewater financing of $2 million from free cash and $1 million from the Town Wastewater Enterprise Fund to appropriate the total of $3 million to the Town Wastewater Stabilization Fund. The operating budget also adds an assistant wastewater superintendent position for $93,000 to oversee construction of the collection system and Buck Island Road treatment facility. Demand for all types of town services have increased, the Finance Committee said in its town meeting report. Recent ambulance service usage exceeds historical levels by more than 15%. That increase prompted the addition of 4 EMT firefighter positions in the current budget and the proposed fiscal 2025 budget, and possibly 4 more in the following year. Half of the wages are paid through ambulance receipts, Rittenauer said. The town meeting will be asked to delete a chapter of the Yarmouth Code that was adopted on February 12th of 1894 that created a seal for the town, and to create a new seal based on a recommendation of a town seal committee and the select board. Article 13 doesn't ask for money, but for authorization to apply for a Massachusetts Public Library grant that would cover 50% of planning and design costs up to $100,000 for library expansion. We have two beautiful libraries, but they are small, Rittenour said. Expansion would allow for more programs, he said. The community has overwhelmingly communicated a need for improvements to the town library facilities and services, according to consultants working with a planning committee. A town wetlands bylaw that was last revised in 1987 will also be voted on at the town meeting. Rittenour said it includes no new requirements but updates the bylaw and incorporates state law changes such as the Rivers Act. The last article asks for a one-year extension on zoning article on short-term rentals to allow more study by the planning board. Keeping it local, we will move to sports and high school baseball. Upper Cape uses pitching and defense to stay unbeaten by Courtney Jacobs and Bourne. The Upper Cape baseball team now stands alone. After the Rams' 3-2 victory over Sturgis Monday, they're now the only unbeaten team left on Cape Cod. As if that wasn't enough, the Rams have started the season 6-0 for the first time in the program. Upper Cape head coach Gabe Coutinho said that the early success has been because of two things. The defense and pitching has been the story, really, Coutinho said. Our pitching has just been great. Not a lot of walks and just throwing strikes. The field has been good. The Rams needed the two things that have them undefeated in their win over Sturgis. The Rams' pitching and defense held Sturgis scoreless as they headed into the bottom of the sixth inning with just a 1-0 lead. Sturgis didn't go quietly as they scored two runs in the sixth and had their first lead of the game. Now the Rams had just one inning to keep their five-game win streak alive. Coutinho said before the Rams went into the seventh inning, he huddled them up and kept it simple. What's better than a comeback win? Let's go and get it done, Coutinho said. The Rams picked up one run on an error by Sturgis as Mitchell Kirkland stole home from third base. Now the score was tied 2-2. Tyler Coutil was the starting pitcher, but now he had the opportunity to give his team a lead. Coutil stepped up to the plate after nearly pitching a complete game and hit an RBI double that was the winner for the Rams. As far as Coutil being effective on the mound and at the plate, he said he uses them together. If I start doing bad at one of them, I just think, do better on the other one, level it all out, Coutil said. When I'm doing good in both, I just try to keep it up. Coutil held Sturgis to zero runs over the first five innings, but was relieved in the sixth by Devin Schultz. We have to keep it there. Don't let them get any more runs, Schultz said about closing the game out. Schultz, along with the defense of the Rams, gave up no runs in the bottom of the seventh. The comeback was complete. The Rams look to remain as the lone unbeaten team on Cape, but this will be their hardest stretch of the schedule as they play four games in 5 days. The good part about it is that all the games will be played on the Rams' home field. As far as the win streak goes, Coutinho said the goal is to win the next game. And when it comes to the rest of the season, it's about how you start. It's not about how you start, but how you finish. There are a lot of typos in this particular article. It's a very poorly edited article. We want to finish strong. We're hoping to host in the state's tournament, Coutinho said. Sturgis played in their first game in 11 days since April 11th. They've only played in three games, while every other team on the Cape has played in at least four. Although they started off slowly with no runs, they started playing better as the game went on. Coutinho even noticed the fight in Sturgis in the game and said he has a lot of respect for them. They're a good, scrappy team, Coutinho said. They threw strikes, they made their plays, and it just came down to a play here and there. That's baseball. We certainly could have been on the losing end, for sure. Well, we had a week layoff and we haven't played any games, Sturgis head coach Larry Schell said. Moving forward, Schell said that Sturgis can't give up runs late in the game like they did against Upper Cape if they want to be successful. We have to play solid defense and make the plays we can and not give away freebies, Schell said. We're not constructed offensively to score a lot of runs, but we have to play a lot of solid defense. Also in school sports, high school roundup, Nantucket girls lacrosse wins their sixth straight by Courtney Jacobs. Bailey Lower scored 9 goals, had 3 assists and 10 draw controls, while Emerson Pekarchik finished with 8 goals in the Nantucket, which is 6-0, girls lacrosse team's 17-6 win over Nauset, 5-2, they're 5-2, on Monday. Evie Stahl with two assists, Sydney Moskrop with one assist, and Mason Lower with five draw controls contributed for Nantucket, while Calloway Mizzarelli had seven saves in goal. Sienna Reeves scored four goals for Nauset. In other high school action in girls lacrosse, it was Upper Cape 10, Tri-County Reg 4. It was New Bedford 15, Bourne 4, Falmouth 13, Monomoy 10. In boys lacrosse, it was Upper Cape 10, Tri-County Reg 9, Monomoy 11, Bourne 9. St. John Paul II 16, Cape Tech 2, Sandwich 16, Hull 0, Falmouth 9, Westwood 7. In girls tennis, it was Plymouth South 5, Dennis Yarmouth 0, Wareham 3, Mashpee 2, Cape Cod Academy 3, Monomoy 2, Sandwich 5, East Bridgewater 0, and in girls tennis, rounding it out, St. John Paul II 5, Carver 0. In boys tennis, it was Plymouth South 4, Dennis Yarmouth 1, Cape Cod Academy 4, Monomoy 1, Mashpee 3, Wareham 2, and St. John Paul II 2, Carver 1. In baseball, it was Nauset 9, Bishop Stang 8, Upper Cape 3, Sturgis 2, East Bridgewater 10, Sandwich 2, Mashpee 4, Monomoy 1. It was Cape Tech 3, over Nantucket 2. It was Archbishop Williams over St. John Paul II 4-3. Seekonk beat Bourne 4-0, Barnstable over Doherty Memorial 12-2, and Boston Latin Academy 9, Nantucket 7. In softball, it was Pembroke 11, Falmouth 3, Upper Cape 32, Mashpee 1. So Seekonk 10, Bourne 1. It was Nauset 37, beating St. John Paul II with 21. East Bridgewater scored 12, Sandwich scored 0 as East Bridgewater won. In boys volleyball, it was Barnstable 3, Taunton 1, and in girls golf, it was Monomoy 5, Dennis Yarmouth 1. And that concludes the high school sports and local sports coverage in the Cape Cod Times for today, Wednesday, April 24th of 2024. Moving to national or international news, colleges see more protests on campuses by John Bacon, Eduardo Cuevas, and Anna Kaufman of USA Today. Colleges across the nation were bracing for more demonstrations today after days of protests, campus closures, and arrests swirling around U.S. support for Israel and its war on Hamas. The protests fueled a national debate over free speech and student demonstrations amid growing unrest over the fate of Palestinians in Gaza and concerns for the safety of Jewish students at home. Dozens of protesters were arrested Monday during pro-Palestinian demonstrations at Yale University in Connecticut and at NYU in Manhattan. Hundreds of students at Stanford University held a walkout, while students at the University of California, Berkeley, erected a Free Palestine encampment. Students at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor set up a protest camp of about 25 tents with banners that read, "Encampment for Gaza, Divest Now, and Long Live the Intifada." New York's Columbia University, which is the epicenter of the demonstrations, announced that classes will provide a virtual learning option, where classroom technology permits, until spring semester ends on May 10th. "Safety is our highest priority as we strive to support our students' learning and all the required academic operations," the university said in a statement. The protests stem from the clash between Hamas and Israel, ignited by the militant group's assault on Israeli communities, October 7th, that killed almost 1,200 people, actually almost 1,300 people. Israel's subsequent bombardment and invasion of Gaza has killed tens of thousands of Palestinians, according to the Hamas registry, and fueled a dire humanitarian crisis. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona called for calm in a social media post on Tuesday, saying universities are at their best when they promote the respectful exchange of diverse views and constructive debate. The Education Department's Office for Civil Rights interprets the civil rights laws and enforces consistent with free speech and other First Amendment rights, he said. "But we won't tolerate hate or harassment that targets students because of who they are or who they're perceived to be. New York University's Manhattan campus was quiet Tuesday following pro-Palestinian demonstrations that led to scores of arrests a day earlier. Outside the Stern School of Business, cameras were trained on a set of barricades while a man held a sign reading, "Israel kills 1,400 kids." Nearby, Nikhil Chirumanmila, 21, who's a senior studying dramatic writing, looked on. He saw the protest Monday but chose not to get involved when he spotted police in riot gear. Referencing an email NYU President Linda Mills sent out in the aftermath, he said her reasoning for the response seemed flimsy. "I feel the university response was a bit dramatic. I think it was a peaceful protest," he said, adding that the university is clear on their position on the matter. They're not as open to pro-Palestinian voices on campus. Mills said she brought in police to NYU after protesters breached barriers with disorderly, disruptive, and antagonizing behavior that interfered with the safety and security of our community, and she said many of them refused to leave. NYU's Professor Association issued a statement Tuesday calling much of the account false and blasted the administration for bringing in the police. The statement said the protest was loud, but there was no intimidation, other than by NYPD, which the group said made arrests in an especially rough manner and pepper sprayed a student who was taking pictures. NYPD did not immediately respond to USA Today's request for comment. Last week, Columbia University President Manoush Shafiq trekked to Washington to face a salvo of tough questions from Republican lawmakers about reports of anti-Semitism on Columbia's campus. A similar hearing in December featuring the presidents of Harvard University and University of Pennsylvania ultimately cost them their jobs. While Shafiq was in Washington, students set up protest camps at the center of campus and demanded the university sever all ties to Israel. The following morning, Shafiq called in New York City police to clear out these demonstrators, and officers arrested more than 100 people. Members of the Columbia University Department of Sociology say they were alarmed by the university's actions. Police have said there was no credible threat to safety from the campus protests. The group issued a statement Tuesday saying the suspensions of students arrested was irregular, unnecessary, and it was resting on shaky legal ground. The educators called on the school to reverse the suspensions and allow the students to return to the campus and to the classes and likely to the protests. Students also want school suspensions to be revoked for some who received them after campus demonstrations in recent months. Columbia grad student Leila Saliba said pro-Palestinian student groups set up tents on campus because they felt protest rallies and walkouts were ignored by administrators. Saliba, who is with the group Columbia University Apartheid Divestment, said multiple student groups, which include many Jewish students, want Columbia to withdraw its investments in companies that profit from the war in Gaza. Saliba, who's 24, said 3 to 4 police helicopters as well as police drones fly over the encampment areas daily. "I don't like it. Makes me feel like I'm a zoo animal," she said, "especially because we're not doing anything wrong." Editorial note, contributing writers to this were Zachary Shimeli and Claire Thornton of USA Today and Niraj Wariku and Hun Fahan of the Detroit Free Press and Reuters, respectively. We're past the midway point in our reading by a few minutes, and regular listeners, I'm sure, are aware. It's at this stage that we move to a different kind of local news, which is the death notices and obituaries that are listed in that day's paper. And in today's Cape Cod Times of Wednesday, April 24th of 2024, there are two obituaries. The first is of Hilda Marie Laukart-Göring, who passed away peacefully at home on the morning of Saturday, the 13th of April. She was surrounded by love as she passed. A longtime Barnstable resident, Hilda was highly involved in many aspects of Cape life starting in the early 1980s. She was born in Brooklyn, raised in White Plains, and graduated from Cedar Crest College in Pennsylvania in 1945 with a degree in sociology. Beginning in the 1950s, Hilda was primary administrator of the Ridgeview Congregational Church in White Plains and was widely considered the heart and soul of the parish. She also worked for the Barnstable Historical Society and the Barnstable Historical Commission for 12 years. She volunteered for many organizations over the years, the Dig and Delve Garden Club, Cape Cod Council of Churches Service Center, the King's Highway Commission, Tales of Cape Cod, and until she chose to stop driving her stick shift at age 97, Friends of Weldon Library. She was honored in 1998 with a Distinguished Service Award for contributions to historic preservation in the town of Barnstable. Hilda was quick to share a laugh, yet slow to self-reveal. While she may have appeared critical at times, she was actually quite accepting of human foibles and faults. She did, however, have a particular disdain for gossip and other forms of foolishness. She had a bold personality while maintaining an intense privacy. She was accepting of the fact that she garnered both supporters and detractors of her outspoken nature throughout much of her adult life. Her ability to size up a situation was sometimes intimidating. She was comfortable with silence and kept room for it. She preferred classical music. Frankly, she didn't care for any other kind, right up until the end of her life, and she'd let you know. After her husband died, she essentially lived to travel. She was fierce about eating healthy gourmet food and much preferred cooking to restaurants. You could say she was known for her soups and baked goods, which she loved to share with friends and family year-round and often donated to bake sales. She found and supported a travel company called the Untours Foundation, mainly because it allowed her to cook while traveling. She made a tradition of cooking dishes indigenous to the places she was visiting. She took beautiful photographs of the scores of countries she was fortunate to enjoy and encouraged people to save their money and make time to see as much of the world as possible, as it broadens perspective while feeding the soul. She put her faith in the cathedral of nature, family, close friends, and simplicity. When pressed, she'd tell you that she had great hopes for humanity, though she was deeply saddened to witness many of the events of the past 9 years. She pointedly stopped watching or listening to news altogether over a year ago. She would like the wars to end. She, herself, is undoubtedly at peace. The other obituary in today's Cape Cod Times of Wednesday, April 24th, is of John DeShuda of East Sandwich. As the tide ebbed and the sun set, we lost one of the very best in John DeShuda on April 20th. John attended Stonehill College, where he met many lifelong friends. Most importantly, he met his best friend, confidant, partner, fellow adventurer, and wonderful wife, Margaret Dink Reardon. John was one of those rare people who could be every man. He could be a teacher or a student, a leader or a follower, a moderator or a listener, an intellectual or a conversationalist. He was always what his family and friends needed him to be. He was every man, and yet a very rare individual. John had a special passion for most everything he did. If he went fishing, he would log the date, temperature, tide, moon phase, and anything else that could affect a fish. He had a garage full of handcrafted fishing rods. He loved all things outdoors, kayaking the Cape marshes, biking along the canal, bird watching most anywhere, snorkeling in the bay, fires on the beach, sunsets over the ocean, and maybe a small glass of wine, or much more. He was an avid reader and could converse about almost any subject, even if he didn't know what he was talking about. Quick to remind you, I'm a freaking genius. He was also passionate about music and had 50 years of playlists that he could call upon for any setting to suit any group. And then there was his golf game, which proves he can't be good at everything. In a word, John was kind, loving, considerate, doting, passionate, honest, humble, empathetic, and totally genuine. Yes, there's no one word to describe John except unique. John could light up a room when talking about Julia and Matt or Jeff or Therese. He could light up a black hole when talking about his grandchildren, Genevieve, Parker, and Josephine. John, your light will continue to burn bright and help guide the path of all those who had the distinct pleasure of knowing you. Well done on a life well lived. See you, John. John will be dearly missed by his wife of 47 years, Margaret, and many, many others who will miss him dearly. Visiting hours will be held on Thursday, April 25th, from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Nickerson Bourne Funeral Home in Sandwich. That's located at 154 Mass 6A in Sandwich. A funeral mass will be celebrated this Friday, April 26th, at 11 a.m. at Our Lady of Victory at 230 South Main Street in Centerville. That concludes the obituaries and death notices that are listed in today's Cape Cod Times, dated April 24th of 2024. To the front of the paper, we will begin to do our national and international news again. Trump trial judge hears arguments on gag order by Aisha Bagchi, Bart Jansen, and Kinsley Curley in New York. The sixth day of Donald Trump's New York hush money trial started with arguments over whether the former president should be held in contempt for allegedly violating a gag order, and then tumbled into the tawdry world of tabloids. Prosecutors say Trump has violated the gag order at least 10 times, and the judge should not only fine the presumptive Republican presidential nominee $1,000 per violation, but warn him he could get jail time if things don't change. In the first criminal trial of a former or current president, Trump faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records. Prosecutors say he tried to cover up unlawfully interfering in the 2016 presidential election through a hush money payment to porn star Stormy Daniels, and it's fraud. The gag order forbids Trump from commenting on jurors, potential witnesses, court staff, and the family members of Judge Juan Merchan and District Attorney Alvin Bragg. He may respond to political attacks. At the Tuesday hearing, prosecutor Christopher Conroy detailed each alleged violation. Many involved Trump going after Michael Cohen, a potential witness. Moreover, Conroy said, Trump again attacked Cohen Monday by telling reporters outside the courtroom that his former personal lawyer got caught lying, pure lying, in a previous trial. Trump defense lawyer Todd Blanche defended his client's statement, saying, he's allowed to respond to political attacks, Your Honor. The judge appeared to grow frustrated after Blanche did not provide specific examples of the attacks to which Trump was said to be responding. The judge said Blanche had neither case law nor evidence to back up his argument. You've presented nothing, Merchan said. I've asked you 8 or 9 times, show me the exact post he was responding to, and you're not even been able to do that once. He added, you're losing all credibility with the court. The judge did not immediately rule on the gag order. During a break, Trump ignored reporters' questions on whether he'll keep posting on Truth Social or if his lawyer has credibility. Instead, he posted, "This is a kangaroo court and the judge should recuse himself!" Then media executive David Pecker retook the witness stand. He met Trump at Mar-a-Lago in the late 80s, Pecker said, and developed a great relationship. Trump was very helpful in introducing Pecker to other media people. He was knowledgeable and very detail-oriented, almost a micromanager, Pecker said. Also, very frugal. Pecker was the president and CEO of National Enquirer's parent company, American Media, Inc., in August of 2015 when he met with Trump and Cohen. According to a Federal Election Commission agreement with the company, Pecker helped, quote, deal with negative stories about Trump by purchasing them, but then not publishing them. It's a practice known as catch and kill. In Tuesday's testimony, Pecker confirmed that with details. He described a meeting about what his magazines could do to help the Trump campaign. Knowing that the Trump organization had a very small staff, Pecker promised to be its eyes and ears. If he heard anything negative about Trump or anything about women selling stories, he would notify Cohen, and did. Cohen would then have the stories killed, Pecker testified. The agreement, Pecker told Cohen, had to be highly confidential, quote-unquote. When Trump announced his bid, Pecker expected that a number of women would try to sell their stories because Trump was well known as the most eligible bachelor and dated the most beautiful women, he said. It was common for women to call up a place like the National Enquirer to sell their stories during someone's political run, he said. The plan also included Cohen planting negative stories about Trump's opponents. The lawyer would call Pecker up, on Trump's behalf, it seemed, and say, we would like for you to run a negative article on a certain political opponent. Then Cohen would send information about, say, Ted Cruz or Ben Carson or Marco Rubio, and we would embellish it from there, Pecker said. One example, a story from March 2016 entitled Ted Cruz Sex Scandal, 5 Secret Mistresses. As Roll Call reported at the time, Cruz vehemently denied the allegation, and no one except for Trump associate Roger Stone presented any evidence that the Texas senator had ever misbehaved. Pecker also gave an example of a negative story that surfaced about Trump. Dino Sajudin, a doorman at Trump Tower, was looking to sell a story about Trump allegedly fathering a child with a maid. "I immediately called Michael Cohen," Pecker said. Cohen replied that the story's absolutely not true, but said he would check it out, according to Pecker. Sajudin's story has been widely questioned. Sajudin claimed only to have been told about the child, and the New Yorker uncovered no evidence that Trump fathered the child. Trump has denied Sajudin's story. If it had been true, it would have been the biggest National Enquirer story since the death of Elvis Presley, Pecker said. And Cohen agreed that the Enquirer could publish it after the 2016 presidential election. However, in investigating the story, Pecker's team concluded the story was untrue. Pecker said he still paid $30,000 to keep it from getting out through another media outlet and hurting the Trump campaign. Cohen thanked him, adding, "The boss will be very pleased." What was in it for Pecker? The Apprentice was helpful to Pecker's magazines because the audience for the National Enquirer and other celebrity magazines followed Trump religiously, Pecker said. Jury proceedings ended at 2 p.m. for the Passover holiday. Though the trial's not televised, New York courts announced Monday they would publish daily transcripts of the proceedings to the New York State Unified Court System's press website by the end of the following business day. Reuters contributed to that story. Israeli strikes are intensifying across Gaza. Officials say 310 bodies found in mass grave at Gaza's Nasser Hospital. By Nidal al-Maghrabi and Emma Farge of Reuters. Israeli strikes intensified across Gaza on Tuesday in some of the heaviest shelling in weeks, pounding the north from where the Israeli army had previously drawn down its troops, residents said. Strikes by air and shelling from tanks on the ground were also reported in central and southern areas in what residents said were almost nonstop bombardments. Overnight, tanks made a new incursion east of Beit Hanun on the northern edge of the Gaza Strip. Though they didn't penetrate far into the city, residents and Hamas media said. Gunfire reached some schools, causing panic among displaced residents that are sheltering there. In Israel, where government offices and businesses were shut to celebrate the Jewish Passover holiday, incoming rocket alerts sounded in southern border towns, although no casualties were reported. The armed wing of Islamic Jihad, a group allied to Hamas, claimed responsibility for the rocket attacks on Sderot and Nir Am, indicating fighters were still able to launch them almost 200 days into the war, which has flattened large swathes of the enclave and displaced almost all of its 2.3 million people. Thick black smoke could be seen rising in northern Gaza from across the southern Israeli border. Shelling was intense east of Beit Hanun and Jabalia and continued on Tuesday in areas such as Zaytun, one of Gaza City's oldest suburbs, with residents reporting at least 10 strikes in a matter of seconds along the main road. Just west of Beit Hanun in Beit Lahia, an airstrike hit a mosque, killing a boy and injuring several others, while a medic was killed in shelling near the town stadium, medics said. A separate strike in Beit Lahia hit a crowd gathering on the coastal road to collect aid dropped from the air. Reuters could not immediately confirm those targets or whether there were casualties. Elsewhere in the enclave, shelling hit the east of the main southern city, Khan Yunis, a day after tanks raided the area. And in the central district, four bodies were recovered from a house hit overnight in the al-Nusayrat refugee camp. The Israeli army said rockets launched overnight into Israel had come from northern Gaza. It had struck rocket launchers and killed several militants in what it called targeted and very precise strikes. Over the past day, IAF fighter jets and additional aircraft struck approximately 25 terror targets throughout the Gaza Strip, including military infrastructure, observation posts, terrorists, and launch posts, it said in a statement. The renewed shelling and bombing of northern Gaza comes almost 4 months after the Israeli army announced it was drawing down its troops there, saying Hamas no longer controlled those areas. This month, Israel also drew down most of its forces in southern Gaza. But efforts to reach a ceasefire have failed, and Israeli bombardment and raids on territory where its troops have withdrawn are making it difficult for displaced Gazans to return to abandoned homes. Israel says it's seeking to eradicate the terror group Hamas, which controls the enclave, following an attack by the militant group on October 7th, killing 1,300 and taking 253 hostages by Israeli tallies. Across the Gaza Strip, Israel's military strikes killed 32 Palestinians and wounded 59 others in the past 24 hours, Palestinian health authorities, which is Hamas-run, said. They say more than 34,000 people have been confirmed killed in the seven-month war, and thousands more bodies as yet unrecovered. Again, that is from the Hamas health registry. Turk are horrified by mass grave reports at Gaza hospitals. UN Rights Chief Volker Turk said Tuesday he was horrified by the destruction of the Nasser and al-Shifa medical facilities in Gaza and reports of mass graves containing hundreds of bodies there, according to a spokesperson. Palestinian authorities reported finding scores of bodies in mass graves at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis this week after it was abandoned by Israeli troops. Bodies were also reported at the al-Shifa site following an Israeli special forces operation. "We feel the need to raise the alarm because clearly there have been multiple bodies discovered," said Ravina Shamdasani, the spokesperson for the United Nations High Commissioners for Human Rights, adding Turk said he had been horrified by the reported mass grave discoveries and the hospital's destruction. Some of them had their hands tied, which of course indicates serious violations of international human rights law and international humanitarian law, and these need to be subjected to further investigation. She added that the UN Human Rights Office was working on corroborating Palestinian officials' reports that 283 bodies were found at Nasser, 30 at al-Shifa. According to these reports, some of the bodies were buried beneath piles of waste, and they included women and older people. Again, the reports came from Hamas. Gaza's Hamas-run Civil Emergency Service said Tuesday a total of 310 bodies had been found at a mass grave at Nasser so far. Two other graves had been identified but not yet excavated. Israel's military and its diplomatic mission in Geneva were not immediately available for comment on the Jewish Passover holiday. Israel says Hamas militants use hospitals as bases, especially in their basements and underground, and that its forces killed around 200 militants at al-Shifa and avoided harming any civilians. Turk, who was represented by Shamdasani at a UN news briefing, also decried Israeli strikes at Gaza in recent days, which he said killed mostly women and children. He also repeated a warning against a full-scale incursion on Rafah, which some 1.2 million civilians are crowded together with the remainder of Hamas, saying this could lead to further atrocity crimes. The next headline, a report says more U.S. Catholics are backing legal abortion, by Mark Ramirez. A solid and growing majority of U.S. Catholics say abortion should be legal in most cases, despite the Church's staunch opposition to the practice, an issue many believe could play a crucial role in the November elections. Additionally, while the portion of U.S. adults who are Catholic remains steady at about 20%, Hispanic Catholics are largely younger and on the rise, while white Catholics are older and declining as a portion of the population. Both findings were among those recently published by the Pew Research Center in Washington in a report drawing on data from recent national surveys. The Pew statistics confirm what is obvious on the ground, said Jonathan Tan, a professor of Catholic Studies at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. The U.S. Catholic Church, once predominantly Irish, Italian, and German, and shaped by 19th and early 20th century immigration, has become increasingly diverse and pluralistic. But it was Catholics' continuing support for legal abortion that stood out among the findings, with about 6 in 10 Catholics saying abortion should be legal, and that's up from 56% in 2019. Nearly 4 in 10 said abortion should be legal in most cases, with 22% saying it should be legal in all cases. Support was split largely along party lines, with 78% of Catholic Democrats saying abortion should be legal in most or all cases, compared to 43% of Catholic Republicans. Support was slightly higher among Hispanic Catholics, 63%, than white Catholics, 59%. That's one reason Jamie Manson, president of advocacy organization Catholics for Choice, said her group has been gearing up to mobilize voters in Hispanic-heavy states like Arizona and Florida that have highly restricted reproductive rights and where measures are either on the ballot or pending as organizers collect enough signatures. "We're prioritizing those regions, and we're putting organizers on the ground, and all our materials are available in Spanish," Manson said. "I think Catholics are going to win this, specifically Hispanic Catholics." About 57% of the nation's approximately 52 million Catholics are white. falling from 65% in 2021. Meanwhile, Hispanics now make up a third of all Catholics, a bump of 4 percentage points. Catholics tend to be older than most Americans, the survey found, with about 6 in 10 Catholic adults aged 50 or older, compared with 48% of the overall U.S. population. White Catholics comprise the majority of that group, with more than two-thirds of white Catholics falling in the age range, compared to just 43% of Hispanic Catholics. Nearly 4 in 10 white Catholics are 65 and older, compared to just 14% of Hispanic Catholics, the study found. However, Hispanics aren't a demographic the Catholic Church can take for granted, said Michelle Dillon, a professor of sociology at the University of New Hampshire. While people with roots in South and Latin America were once considered staunchly Catholic, she pointed out many are shifting to evangelical Christian churches or no religious affiliation. Given the marketplace for religions, there's a lot more choice, Dillon said. The church is stable and even in a strong position, but it has to do the work of energizing new generations. The big challenge is maintaining relevance. The number of U.S. Latinos who identify as Catholic has dropped sharply in the past dozen years. Pew Research published last year showed that just 43% of Latinos identified as Catholic. That's down from 67% in 2010. Dillon said white Catholics tend to be more economically and educationally established than Hispanic Catholics. Should that gap continue, she said, it could produce internal segregation within Catholicism and individual churches. White and Hispanic differences continued among political party lines as well. The recent Pew data showed that among registered voters, about 6 in 10 white Catholics identify with or lean toward the Republican Party, with the same percentage of Hispanic Catholics identifying with or leaning toward the Democratic Party. We'll finish off our reading of the Cape Cod Times of Wednesday, April 24th, with a bit of advice from Ask Carolyn, Carolyn Hacks. Dear Carolyn, a close friend in another state didn't tell me about her daughter's wedding for 9 months. If she had offered various excuses, such as, it was a small wedding, I would have respected that and not have pushed to go. It was not being informed that bothered me. We speak for hours at a time, at least twice a week. I was shocked and hurt and told her so when she apologized, but I am still astounded. It feels like a betrayal. What say you? The answer, well, that is definitely not good. But is it in character for her? And here's why I'm asking. Your scenario reminds me of one a friend of mine faced years ago. Has the same bones, discovery, huge disappointment, and an active struggle to get past it. Relief finally came from my friend in the form of an aha moment. The source of the disappointment, the root cause for this particularly bad outcome had been there all along. And she had been fully aware of it too. The issue simply hadn't presented itself before in such an obvious or consequential way as it did this time. Making that connection meant she could draw on her prior experience dealing with it and her having emerged just fine before. Sorry for being so oblique. Splashing out friends' disappointments in my column is not a great way to keep friends. Sorry, too, for the advisory detour for what probably seems like a long shot. But what you describe is such an odd thing to happen between friends in such close contact, my first reaction is to look for something normal in it. So, is it in character for this friend to shove things aside that make her uncomfortable? Is denial her coping strategy of choice right up to the moment life makes denial impossible? Because avoidant tendencies could explain a bizarro silence like this. Exclusion from a wedding guest list is hard news to hear for sure. But don't forget, it's also really, really hard news to deliver to a friend. And some people's hard news delivering skills fall somewhere between god-awful and non-existent. If your friend routinely chickens out of tough conversations, I'd argue this isn't a betrayal so much as a logical, if hurtfully extreme, extension of the person she's always been, the person who's still such a close friend that you talk for hours at a time, multiple times a week. Whether my hunch about your friend is right or wrong, your options are the same. Accept her apology, trust she meant no harm, and resume the friendship as usual. Or raise the subject again, say you believe her apology sincere but struggle to understand her reasons, and then ask if she's willing to share. Or treat this as a caution flag and proceed slowly from here, watching for other signs of trouble. Or finally, decide the injury to the friendship was a mortal one. I hope it isn't. From where I sit, few things in life have more value than long talks, twice a week, friendship, even one who's a little bit weird. And with that good advice, we've come to the end of our reading of the Cape Cod Times of April 24th. This is your reader, Eric, saying be well, be safe, look after each other, and remember our veterans. Bye for now.